From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
You know the routine. I ring up my longtime friend Ken Drews on Skype each month, and then, with you listening, we tackle your urgent garden questions, which this time range from growing pansies from seed to trees in pots, keeping garden journals, and more. But first, these messages.
Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/AwayToGarden. Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Thanks for submitting lots of good urgent garden questions this month for me and Ken Drews to answer. And you can always ask us anything, urgent or otherwise, on facebook.com/awaytogarden or in comments on the Away to Garden website or using the contact form there or on kendrews.com. So now that we've got the housekeeping details out of the way, Ken, what do you say we dig right into the latest listener questions? And by the way, hello, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. And Margaret, you know, I was lecturing in the Berkshires recently.
You were lecturing me again.
Lecturing you.
Yes.
No, you were there and you were lovely.
Oh, it was sweet of you to shout me out. Thank you very much for the nice, kind regards in our local crowd here. So, and it was very fun and it was a great lecture. So thank you.
Thank you.
And there were cookies. And if there's cookies, I'm happy. So, pansy germination. Rosa from Facebook says, help about how to germinate pansy seeds, please. She always thought they needed to be surface sown, very lightly covered in soil, and then left in darkness or covered with dark plastic or something like that to germinate. And now she's reading they don't need darkness, and she likes to grow the big Swiss ones and also little Johnny Jump-Ups. So she was just curious, has something changed? Have you grown them from seed?
Not for probably 30, 40 years.
Yeah, and you remember
so
the darkness
you take
thing.
This.
But you remember the darkness thing too, right? I mean, it used to,
yeah, right.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, what I have read everywhere is that I don't know if anything changed. I mean, I don't know. But what I do know is that one of the keys to growing them is growing them cool, right? Because they're a cool season crop. And the worst thing you can do is put them under hot lights or in a really warm room and let them sort of stretch and grow too fast, you know, reaching for light or just from the heat and so forth. And they take a long time. So it's like, gee, it can be 2 to 3 months, even 3 months, you know, before frost that you sow them. So it's not something, you know, you do at the last minute at all. And I think the key is you cover the seeds lightly. And what you don't want to do is, like, splash water on them from the top, which actually I think is true with a lot of things you sowed in cells or flats. You want to bottom water because what you don't want is for them to get, like, buried, swamped, you know, with soil, with potting medium sort of splashing up on them and them getting deeper and deeper and deeper. So I haven't read lately anywhere that they say absolute darkness. So cool, I think, is important. High light levels, you know, want to really minimize stretching with these guys. But just a teeny bit of soil on top. What do you think? Sound good?
Yeah, it sounds hard, too, if you live in a house.
Yeah, of course. And that's why I think a lot of us just buy them as an early spring crop, you know, when the garden center's open, that's usually the first thing they have in the north where we live, right?
Right.
Is pansies and violas, so.
But in the south, you buy them in the fall, and they're
right.
They last, they bloom sometimes through the winter, and then the spring or even, you know, March, they're in full bloom.
Yeah, and I think probably, again, it's that time investment. It's sort of like growing onions from seed in a sense. You know, it's not going to happen. You don't give it 2 or 3 weeks inside like you might a squash, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you might give a little head start to something like that. Whereas, you know, you're talking 10 weeks or something. So, right? I mean, and I don't think they're indoors for that whole period of time. But just what I'm saying is you're backed up so far before frost when you're starting. A lot of people aren't in gear yet, you know, for their seed starting. Yeah, I'm not in gear, I'll tell you that. So Al on Facebook wants to know what kind of trees or shrubs would be good in a pot for privacy on a patio. Okay. Doesn't have to be evergreen, because I guess he uses the patio seasonally. He's in zone 6B and would like to be able to leave it out all year. And it's the southwest side of the house, so sun from sunrise to roughly 5 p.m. in the summer. And, you know, some of the things he was thinking about were, like, boxwood, espaliered dwarf apple. You grow a lot of things in pots, so do I. So,
well, and I used to have a roof garden, and I grew a whole lot of things. And I guess
like everything.
First, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's all I could do.
Yeah.
The first thing I would say is choose a plant that's hardy to at least one zone colder than where you are, because containers not right. only freeze down from the top like the earth, they freeze in from the sides and up from the bottom. So you really need a very hardy plant. And then there's heat tolerance and reflected light from
right,
the
patio. Right, baking the roots, right?
And you yeah. also said it's in the, you know, it's going to get the winter sun, which is not so great for evergreens.
Yeah. Well, and he's saying evergreen is optional, but the boxwood he's suggesting would be evergreen. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if Al's interested in pruning, but I would definitely consider beech trees, because you can just prune them and prune them and prune them and make anything you want. You can make a solid screen, but you would have to prune them every year, probably twice.
Mm-hmm.
You could get carpinus. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you call that? Ironwood, and what's another name for carpinus betulus? You know all the common names.
Well, you think I'm going to be able to think of it when you give me a quiz out loud like that? But I know carpinus,
yeah, right.
Yes.
I know. We always do that. Well, there's Carpinus fastigiata, which is narrow growing naturally. And I think those would be great in pots. And uh-huh. they're very similar looking to the beech trees. The leaves are a little bit smaller.
Now, the beech sometimes hold on to their leaves into the
so
winter.
So does the Carpinus.
Okay. Sometimes. Okay. All right. So.
Well, there's also fastigiate European beech, like Dawick purple. That's Fagus sylvatica.
Right.
Sylvatica.
Yeah.
I'm into pruning. I'm like excited about this. I think this is great.
Well, and he said espalier dwarf apple tree. So that sort of gave the hint that he was almost thinking of like a living flattened sort of wall, you know, that involves pruning.
That's harder. And it also, you could see through it.
Yeah.
And it certainly, if he's into espalier, that's a whole lot more pruning than a beech tree.
Yeah.
So I guess choose what you can choose. I think the espalier, if he's into it, espalier would be great. Apples, but you could see through it, and it would take a lot of pruning, maybe even spraying of some kind, you know, an organic spray. But
right.
fruit trees, that's work.
Yeah, I find that the among the espalier things, and I was given a tip on this years ago when I was going to invest in one for a particular spot at my house, and the nurseryman said Asian pear, that they have more disease resistance. The leaves stay nicely unblemished and glossy. The flowers are beautiful and profuse and early. You don't lose the flower to a late frost. They seem to be tougher. The fruit is lovely, you know, kind of round. It can be various sizes, and mostly it's yellow.
Delicious.
And it can be delicious. Some varieties are less, more watery, and some are more tasty. But that's less troublesome to grow, I think, that way than in terms of the disease stuff, than an apple, for example. Asian pear.
But, and I know you have an Asian pear, and
yeah.
it's espaliered, but it's on the wall.
Yes.
And that's kind of a different story than
yes.
having some kind of structure or frame, because that Asian pear is a little vigorous.
It is.
So,
to keep
that shape, it would be quite a bit of work.
I was just reacting to the, if you're going to grow a fruit thing, I'd grow the Asian pear.
Yep.
That way, because of the less, it's less, they look less messy from diseases.
Yeah.
You know, I think the other thing is that you were saying, you were inferring when, I think from the boxwood, you were mentioning about evergreen and saying, you know, being out there in the sun in the winter and, you know, implying like, okay, they might get beat up, you know, wind burned and sunburned and stuff like that. I think that's what you were sort
yes.
of hinting at. And one of the things I do with all the things I grow, big except for one, I have one, I guess it's a yew that I have in a very big pot right when you first come up the walk, and that's out all the time. But that's a sort of protected spot, not a soft spot that bakes in the winter or gets too wind-whipped. And all the rest, I roll them on a hand cart into a more protected place or even into the garage. So since he doesn't need the screen in winter, the other thing Al can do if he picks something that he wants to give a little protection, it could be mobile. I mean, you know, it's still going to be a big pot, but I mean, I have giant pots. You know, they're thigh high, top of my thigh high, and, you know, two and a half feet wide, whatever the width of a big pot is. What is it? 30 inches, I think, 20 something inches. You know, they're big, but they can't take it out in the winter. The things would be a mess. The evergreen things would be a mess. So I put them in. I have, you know, conifers in those. I have that Thuja de Groot spire. Do you know that one? It's kind of narrow.
No, that sounds good.
Nice. It's very nice. I think, is it a Thuja? Is that what I meant to say?
Yeah, yeah.
De Groot spire. And, you know, so again, I give them a little protection in the winter, but, you know, out of the sun and wind. But, yeah, I think that possibilities are limitless. And then there's also staging to create privacy. Like, say you had an espalier as your backdrop, if that was really attached to espalier, you could stage in front of it toward where you sit, right? You could stage smaller pots, you know, and kind of have this, that as the backdrop. And
or even make it a backdrop behind that.
Exactly, you know, exactly. So layering the pot display, right?
Because I did grow boxwood sempervirens Graham Blandy in pots because I didn't get them in the ground. And they were in pots for probably 5 or 6 years. And they did just fine, but they didn't really grow. You know, they sort of stayed the same height, even though they survived.
Right.
So that's something else to think about, is it's going to dwarf the plants.
It does dwarf. I mean, my De Groot spire is a fraction of its potential self because it's root pruned. It's, you know, it's being kept small. Yeah.
It's like a demi semi bonsai.
Yeah, but I mean, I think there's a huge palette, depends on your preference visually and what the place looks like and what will go with it. But like you said, a little hardier. As I said, maybe you have to, if it has evergreen foliage, you know, maybe you want to move it slightly into a protected spot for the winter, et cetera. So lots of possibilities, though. So on to the next question, yes?
Mm-hmm.
So Joan, also on Facebook, is asking. She says, by the way, not at all urgent, just curious. So do either of us maintain any type of written garden journal? Now we have to tell the truth, Ken. If so, what have you found useful to record? I can answer the second part of the question better than I can answer the first, because since I started the website, which is actually 10 years in March 2018, 10 years after anniversary, when I started waytogarden.com, that kind of became my record keeping in a way, you know, and that and my photo library, which is chronological, right? Those two things help me to know what's happened. But then I also do write some things down. What about you?
Well, of course, when I started the garden here 22 years ago, I had all these journals and I was going to write in them. And that lasted about a week and a half.
46 seconds.
Right. But I make. You know, I put it in the computer and make notes of what I want to buy or what I want to prune. I make most of the notes in the winter about things I, you know, walk around and think, oh, I got to do that in the spring because you'll forget. And if I see a plant I want, I write it down in the computer and just have a file. But like you said, the pictures are great because you take a picture of something and it's got all the information, the date, the time that you took it. Sometimes what the light was like, you know, there's all this hidden information.
Right.
And that can be your version of a journal.
Yes. And I think one of the other things about pictures is that when we go out to our own gardens, or for that matter, when we look at ourselves in the mirror, you know, we have a different filter about what's going on, right? Like we have a subjective view. Or maybe we're going out and we think we're taking a picture of X, but actually we stepped back a little bit and we're showing six things that are near X, right? That are around X. And so we're getting a lot of information about, is this combination working? Oh, look, that thing over there is like kind of looking ratty and I never noticed that. You know what I mean? I get more out of my pictures. I see more bloopers. I see more opportunities in a picture. Once I'm inside the house and looking at it a little less. I mean, I'm still subjective, but a little less so, just a smidge less so. I sometimes get ideas. So I think photos are super important. So, I mean, you could just open an Instagram account and just slam them up there if you don't have a photo recording, you know, a photo organizing program. You know, you could just do it that way. Or if you have a Mac, you could use their photo program or whatever. You don't have to
mention that people are using their phones. That's because...
Well, that's why I'm saying you could just do it right from your phone to an Instagram account, and then there it is chronologically arranged forever, so to speak, you know.
I think the thing that's happening that with what you're talking about also is that you're seeing things flat. in two dimensions.
Yes.
And we're used to seeing things moving in three dimensions
and
shadow.
The wind
and light.
Is blowing and the sun is warm and it smells pretty and the bird is chirping. And that's a different experience when I'm out there, right?
Yeah. It's like I call that sometimes the third eye.
Yeah. Yeah. So the other stuff about what's useful to record, which I don't get out of a picture, and I don't get out of unless I write a story that cites it, and I think is very important because I'm in an older garden like you are. We've been at it a long time, and from time to time, more than from time to time, all the time, like a label will sort of show up in the compost heap, you know, and I mean, it never happens to you, I know.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, and like some of my labels that show up, they're from Heronswood Nursery, which has been closed for eons, right, out in Seattle. Yes. It was a rare plant nursery back in the day. I don't remember which epimedium that is. I bought 6 epimediums 15 years ago from there, or 20 years. You know, it's... So if I had written it down, or if I had saved my order printout, or printed out my confirmation email from a more recent order from a seed company or a plant company, I think those are really great to like keep in a folder, because then at least you can say, you know what, these are the 5 epimediums I bought. Okay, this one's yellow flowered. That's the yellow one. Okay, the purple one's over there. Okay, that's what that one. You know what I mean? You can almost deduce, even if you didn't keep perfect records.
It's also nice to know when you planted something that is
exactly
that you do know what it is
exactly.
You know.
So
that
I
tree,
think
was that 12 years ago? Was that 6 years ago? Was that 8 years ago?
Yeah. So keep your. I think at the minimum, take pictures and keep all your orders, all your plant orders.
I
and
like
when you
this.
Buy something at the nursery, you got to keep your receipt, right? You got to put that in that folder too. So
yeah.
Okay, there we go. We just invented a new version of Garden Journal.
It's a lot quicker than writing it down.
So here's, speaking of quick, here's a quick question from Sarah, also on Facebook, about shears, best shears for deadheading. She wants ones with big blades, but for one-handed use, so you can hold onto and gather the debris you're cutting. So she wants to use one hand to hold and one hand
I
to
see.
Shear. Do you use, what do you use when you go and
well,
shear
things? Well, she's talking about shears, you know, I'm not sure exactly what that means, because I use shears to cut the edge of the grass sometimes, you know, to edge the grass. And I might, even though I don't recommend it, I can't believe I'm saying it. I had a lot of, because we had such a juicy year last year, I had a lot of fresh growth on some of the boxwood late in the season, and it just burned. As soon as we had, you know, we had warm weather, then we had freeze. So I have a lot of brown, light brown growth on the boxwood.
I'm seeing it everywhere as I drive around the neighborhood. Where
and
I
should do a really good job with my cicadas, with my Felcos. Number two is my favorite. And hold each piece and cut it, which would take, you know, a day.
Right.
So I just go out there sometimes with scissors.
Yeah.
And I just trim off the dead stuff. And I know that the new growth is going to cover that little stubby thing I've done. And I was doing it this last weekend. So I just go out with shears and I let the pieces fall to the ground because they're going to disappear.
Yeah.
And just give it a haircut. So I use sheep shears for edging, or, you know, edging shears, and then scissors.
And I have what are called shop shears. And so shop shears, like workshop or tool shop, shop shears are kind of like, you know, craft scissors have like the bigger plastic handles and the slightly longer, you know, if you're going to do like a textile project, they're like craft scissors. Okay. They have a plastic handle and slightly longer stainless or whatever blades than a regular scissor that you might just use, you know, for clipping something in the house. But shop shears are just a little bit bigger. The handle, so they might be used in a workshop for cutting, not like metal or something, but for, I don't
leather
know.
Or something.
Yeah, something like that. And I'll give a link with the transcript to some of the ones that I've used. And I always have, like every few years, I buy 2 or 3 pairs, and I have them in every, you know, tool bucket around the place and stuff. And I use them for clipping the edges of the grass, and I use them for shearing like a mass of something. But I have to say, I've gotten to the point where I don't even, speaking of not wanting to spend a whole day cleaning something up, I've become like a maniac in the spring with my big masses of epimedium and my geranium macrorhizum after it blooms, epimedium after the winter before it puts up its flowers for the new year, and geranium macrorhizum, or the equivalent ground cover, before it after it blooms in late spring. I use hedge clippers. And I go, you know, I like go at it like a big, isn't that terrible? I can't, I just don't have the time. I have a big garden. I don't have the time, you know. So I've started using head shears for big shearing projects. But I love
I
the shop shears. Yeah.
So you're on your knees, basically.
I am. And I'm going whack, 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 you know,
whack, whack.
With two hands. It's a two-handed thing. But it's great on epimediums. I mean, you get you clean a whole huge stretch of the swath of that in 2 seconds. So FYI.
FYI, right.
So another question. Barbara asks about making more plants. She'd love to hear about making more plants, the title of a Ken Drews book, one of my favorites of your books. She wants to know about lily seeds for bulb production. Do you know anything about this? Because this is not something I've done.
I have done this.
Oh, cool. Okay, so we can make Barbara happy. Okay.
There's
we have
two
about,
kinds of lilies.
Yeah, we have about four or five minutes, by the way, so give us the course.
How much time?
About 4 minutes, 5 minutes.
Oh, that's plenty of time.
Okay, good.
So some of the lilies in the world are come up right away from seed, and some of them don't. And the ones that come up right away are called epigeal. And you can look online for the name of the lily or the lily seeds that you might buy or if you're harvesting from your own plants. And ones like Lilium formosanum, I put those dry seeds in some moist vermiculite, and they sprout in about 3 or 4 weeks, and then I move them into a flat, just pick them up by a true leaf if you can. The leaves are sort of like grass.
Uh-huh.
And they just slip right out of the vermiculite, and I pot them up. Now, the other kinds, like Lilium martagon, the martagon lilies.
Oh, I love those.
They take, I love them, and I love the white ones, so I harvest my own seed from the white ones, and they come true. They come white from seed.
Wow.
So I take the seeds in August when the seed pods, the fruits, are ripe, and I open up the fruits, and I take the seed, and I put them in a Bounty paper towel that I fold and then fold again, or you can use a Selecticize and just fold it over once.
Selecticize, I love it. Yeah, he's so crazy,
moist.
This guy.
Uh-huh. I moisten that and put them in and slip them into a sandwich bag and close it, and it's
so
a good
like,
idea to write on
Yeah,
it,
like you're doing a
is.
Germination test of seeds, sort of-ish.
Exactly.
Okay.
And in about 3 weeks, on the counter, not in the refrigerator or anything, you just put them on the
right.
counter in the kitchen where you're going to see them. In 3 weeks, they don't make leaves like the other ones. They make little tiny bulbs. It's so cute.
Oh, you're
and so
kidding.
I take the bulbs and I pot those up, usually in a flat and not too big a flat. And I'll stick it in the refrigerator, believe it or not, and write do not eat on it and the date that I did it and
right.
what it is.
Do not eat.
And right, take it out in March. Put it in a sunny window or under lights, and they'll sprout leaves. And in that way, you're getting your lily plants going 1 year faster than they would in the garden by themselves.
So wow.
It's fun, too. I do it every year.
And actually. So that works with the ones that are not what's called epigeal?
Those are the hypogeal ones.
Hypogeal. Ones oh, I got to look this up. Okay.
So you look online, you know, if you look up Lilium martagon, you can find that it's hypogeal, and then you know it's going to take, in nature, it takes 2 years to germinate.
Okay,
it's warm, moist, cold, moist, warm, moist, etc.
Okay.
Or you could just follow those directions.
Is that like a double dormancy or something? Is that sort
I
of
guess,
like that?
I guess
I don't know.
Is.
I wonder if that's what that is. Okay. So with the epigeal ones, if we want to get started like lily seed growing from seed 101, we could pick an epigeal one and even have faster results.
Right.
Okay.
Because Lilium formosanum, if you live in, I guess, 6B or warmer, they can sometimes bloom the first year from
oh,
seed.
Oh, wow.
Just one flower and they're short, but they grow to 6 or 7 feet with many flowers. So.
Huh. Very interesting. I didn't know. We have like a minute and a half, and I'm going to ask you a really quick question from
Uh-oh.
Loretta, who has a 4-year-old wisteria intertwined with a honeysuckle and a Paul's Himalayan mush climbing rose. She's got a real tangle. Will this affect the wisteria from blooming? Is it too crowded? She's not had a lot of flowers, and she's wondering, like, these three vines, is that too much?
Oh, my gosh.
That sounds like a lot to me, and especially
it's like
with the wisteria.
It's like the fight of the century.
Yeah. with three fighters in the ring.
Yeah, with, two thugs, and I don't know that much about. Well, that rose is, I know it has big, long canes.
Yeah.
Wow, I don't know how big this space is, but the wisteria, do you know how long she's been doing this?
No, she says she trimmed back last year, but only she trimmed back the wisteria last year, but then it only had 2 single long cascading blooms, and that was it. Yeah.
Well, I think it's dangerous.
And yeah, maybe
it
would
be
a
better
little
to have them on their own. But for the wisteria, I prune my wisteria about once a month until August. And I cut it back to about 5 nodes from the main stem.
Okay.
And then that's how I really get bloom. And I got bloom when they were pretty young doing that. Because they'll make those giant big wands and they wind everywhere. It also depends on what kind of wisteria. And I'm imagining it's the Japanese Floribunda.
Right, right, right.
Or the Chinese. Those are just monsters. I wish her great good luck.
Yes.
And I hope it's not too close to the house.
Yes. All right. So, so we got to a lot of questions. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Ken Drews.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com. Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/AwayToGarden.
Don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden. And find Ken at kendrews.com. And happy gardening from both of us meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.